is a way of making the peace process not to be accepted even by the members of the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia. That is a reality. Boycott of the oligarchy, boycott of the large landowners, boycott of the imperialists. Today, in the peace process that is between the National Liberation Army and President Petro, the extreme right is not only ignoring it, but also placing emphasis on minor issues and at the same time manipulating public opinion in an evil way to let this process fail. Ultimately, it's the Colombian people who will decide the form of struggle and their destiny. And if today the peace process must be carried forward, we must respect it and respect it. I'm Eduardo Artes, and this is Black and White. Today I talk to Mauricio Leandro Osorio. He is a Cuban-Chilean writer and journalist. He is the winner of some national and municipal awards in our country. He's also a political advisor in Colombia during the 2016 peace process with the FARC. You're very welcome to Black and White.
Bienvenido a Negro y Blanco por Hispan TV, Mauricio.
Thank you very much for the invitation, Eduardo.
Mauricio, estamos hoy día en...
We're in the process of negotiations between the Colombian government and the National Liberation Army. What are these negotiations about? How do the antecedents influence the previous negotiations or the previous peace agreements with the FARC made in 2016 and 2017?
In the first place, we must remember that in the last 30 years, there have been seven Colombian governments that tried to establish these dialogues with the National Liberation Army. This time, Gustavo Petro, on August 3, 2023, announced that two important things were going to take place: ceasefire and installation of the National Participation Committee, which is an advance in relations to what was the agreement with the FARC. We remember that the FARC sat down to negotiate with the Colombian government, which was between the guerrilla and the government. This time, we will also witness participation of Colombians in this peace process. Another important thing that will happen is the presence of the National Liberation Army's chief negotiators in Bogota. It had never happened in history. Both parts have always participated in negotiations in another city. Well, these are the historical milestones. It is also important to observe some historical background to understand what the difference is in this new round of dialogues. There are also three important events in the history that the government tried to have dialogues with the National Liberation Army. The first round of negotiations was held in the 90s through Simon Bolivar Guerrilla Coordinating Board, where FARC and Popular Liberation Army were present. This negotiation failed due to the bad political will of the government of Cesar Gaviria, because the government carried out bombings and FARC camps at Casa Verde. It happened on the same day that the Constituent Assembly was installed, so that the negotiations were doomed to failure. The second round of negotiations took place during the presidency of Álvaro Uribe Vélez, between 2005 and 2007. Uribe had an aggressive strategy toward the insurgent forces called Democratic Security Policy. More than 6,400 cases of false positives are documented from that period of time. It was a government that carried out imperialist interventions in Colombia, with military base installations and the implementation of Plan Colombia. His strategies could only intensify the internal Colombia war. The third round of negotiations with Colombian guerrillas took place during Juan Manuel Santos' presidency. It is important to emphasize the difference between previous negotiations with Colombian guerrillas and the one that is being carried out during Gustavo Petro's era. The government of Juan Manuel Santos and previous ones always saw the National Liberation Army as a very small group, and they didn't consider the political character of this guerrilla. In addition, they saw the National Liberation Army as a simple guerrilla that did not have a control unit, but rather functioned more or less federatively. So what happened later? When previous Colombian governments underestimated the National Liberation Army and didn't consider its military and political aspects, the National Liberation Army started to demonstrate its United National Control Unit by an armed strike. They carried out armed strikes and signed ceasefires at the national level. I believe that everything has changed right now. Gustavo Petro understands that he has to give political recognition to a guerrilla that has been fighting for 70 years and that was born as a political vision with great figures in its ranks. Its members are deeply concerned with the term liberation, like priest Camilo Torres and Manuel Perez Martinez in the 90s. So the political recognition of the National Liberation Army is a significant advance. The mistake that can occur in this new round of dialogues is to fall back into the same trap and not give political guarantees to the National Liberation Army and take it as a criminal band or a parliamentary group.
The term force is predominant at the negotiating table. The truth is that after the peace negotiations and reaching agreements with the FARC, the National Liberation Army doubled its violent activities. It was no longer considered simply as a minor guerrilla group.
Simplemente como un grupo guerrillero menor.
That's right. We shall realize this background to understand the new phase of negotiations. The Colombian government and the FARC signed a revised peace deal in 2016. It is important to see what happened in that moment. In that time, FARC abandoned arms in the areas under their control. They were governing in those areas because the Colombian state had abandoned them. The Colombian government forgot about the health service, security guarantees, police, and medical services and making roads in those zones. It was the FARC that carried out all these missions in these abandoned areas. So we witnessed the emergence of parliamentary groups and National Liberation Army as well. This current dialogue occurs at a time of escalation. We are well aware that there is progress in political participation of the FARC, with their political party known as Comunes. Five of the FARC members were in the Senate, and another five were in the Chamber of Deputies. 1,300 social leaders have been murdered so far since the signing of the peace agreement in Colombia. Among them, we can see 330 signatories of the peace agreement.
That is exactly right. The U.S. permanently boycotted the peace agreements. It is important to mention that to this day, Simon Trinidad, who is one of the main leaders of the FARC, is imprisoned in the United States, which makes the situation even more complicated. His absence made the peace process more difficult. The U.S. could easily release him as a political prisoner. Well, these events, assassinations of social leaders and Simon Trinidad's imprisonment, have a clear message and means that they need to enter a new phase. Well, let's have a break and then we will continue our program.
Entrar, digamos, en otro momento. Bueno, vamos a una pausa y continuamos.
We continue our program on Black and White with Mauricio Leandro Osorio. We were talking about an important issue. What do you think about these events related to the FARC? What do you think about today's FARC? I need your opinion to continue our talk regarding the peace negotiations. Your opinion will be useful for Gustavo Petro and the National Liberation Army as well.
Tanto Petro como los helenos.
I believe that there should be certain guarantees for the governments, and they must be implemented correctly. We've been witnessing progressive governments in the recent years. Uribismo has actually boycotted the peace dialogues in the recent years. Many FARC fighters were granted amnesty, and we're bringing the process of integration into civil society were actually murdered in that time. Their security guarantees were not fulfilled. Many social leaders were also murdered. Right now, there is progress in the peace dialogues. We see the political participation of the FARC as Communist Party. There's also a significant point here. There's also advance in the process of justice regarding the reconstruction of what really took place during the armed conflict in Colombia. Unfortunately, the right-wing policy of these pro-imperialist governments was to arrest the parliamentary leaders and extradite them to the United States. These right-wing governments also extradited guerrilla leaders to the U.S., such as Simon Trinidad. These actors should have contributed to the peace and provided reparation to the victims through participation in the special jurisdiction for peace.
Mira, sin saliendo del tema.
Do you think that it is possible to do justice to Simon Trinidad and release him to come back to Colombia and act as a guarantor of peace? It is a demand of all left-wing democratic forces in Colombia and Latin America as well.
Hace bastante sentido eso.
Sería un paso significativo, pero reitero ahí que...
It would be a significant step, but I have to reiterate that this depends on the political will of the government. If there's a progressive government in power, we could move towards these guarantees of security and dialogue until he's freed. They basically expect his freedom. We shall observe the advancement of this dialogue. There's a real impediment in order to reach total peace in Colombia. Colombia's president has a plan for total peace. The role of monitoring and verification organizations is crucial to carry out a ceasefire at a time of escalation of the conflict. We shall realize that there are the National Liberation Army, parliamentary groups, and FARC guerrilla dissidents in Colombia. These dissidents are in conflict over territories abandoned after the agreement. Over 52 massacres took place during 2023 as a result of this conflict in Colombia. So we can't pretend that nothing has happened. We see the renewed outbreak of war. There must be a real ceasefire between the government and the National Liberation Army. But how shall we reassure that the National Liberation Army and other parliamentary groups do not enter into this conflict? It is a really complicated task, but we have to keep trying to reach peace.
Hay que seguir intentando avanzar en la paz, ¿no?
Así es. Bueno, tenemos que...
That's right. The form of struggle obeys a special historical moment for specific needs. I believe that the entire history of Colombia has been ruled by dictators. Colombia hasn't enjoyed democratic moments so much. That's why there are the FARC, the National Liberation Army, the Popular Liberation Army, and the 19th of April movement. Gustavo Petro was also a member of the 19th of April movement in that certain period of time. The armed conflict in Colombia is transversal, from socio-democratic organizations such as the 19th of April movement to others that claim to be communists. It is a constant conflict. The armed conflict was actually the only way to make policies. The armed conflict in Colombia, Latin America, and the world has an expiry date. What do you think? I have my opinion, but I am not going to mention it right now.
I think that first we must know about Colombia. Colombia continues to be one of the bastions of the U.S. imperialism in Latin America, along with Chile. There are 7 U.S. military bases in Colombia. Colombia is a strategic ally of the NATO. The Colombian state doesn't guarantee the security, education, healthcare, and other services in different Colombian territories, and that's why there's a continuous war. Drug trafficking is a key element in Colombian internal conflict. Drug trafficking also causes various problems. Many Popular Liberation Army soldiers are connected to drug trafficking. Many people in Colombia have told me, I didn't turn into a guerrilla fighter because I used to read Marx. I turned into a guerrilla fighter because the Colombian army and parliamentary soldiers assassinated my family members. So I joined the guerrilla groups to stay alive. I wanted to take revenge from my family. There was a guerrilla fighter that told me, if the parliamentary groups find me, I will join them. If the FARC find me, I will join them as well. And I hope that the FARC will find me. I mean that they didn't have a profound political and ideological background to join these groups. They only wanted to ensure their lives. Many of these guerrilla fighters used to tell me, I'm going to sign a paper to ensure my life in the becoming years. 330 guerrilla fighters signed these papers and were finally assassinated.
Una de las dificultades grande que tiene la paz.
The power in the hands of landowners is one of the many obstacles to reach peace in Colombia. How have they used their power with bloodshed and fire? They have treated the peasants as slaves. They have also overexploited the resources of peasants. As a professional journalist, what do you think about the role of these sectors in Colombia?
This sector of Colombian society is among the actors that has intensified the internal conflict. We shall include them in the citizen participation, just like the FARC. This is the only way to control such actor in the internal conflict. So, participation committee in facilitating the inclusive participation of Colombian society in the peace process is very important. This committee has the responsibility to invite the relatives of the assassinated peasants in the negotiation and guarantee the lives of guerrilla fighters and peasants' families in rural areas as well.
A las organizaciones campesinas y rurales.
Ahora, en el contexto latinoamericano,
there is a really complex situation in Latin America. The U.S. is now the first world power. It is actually becoming stronger every day. Can the U.S. become an impediment to the peace process negotiations in Colombia? We should consider this point that the U.S. thinks that Latin America is its backyard. Latin America may be the last bastion of the U.S. because it has lost Africa and Asia. There are other conflicts in the world as well. How could the U.S. impact the peace negotiations in Colombia?
¿Cómo podría eso repercutir, no, negativamente en la firma de la paz?
Bueno, yo tengo ahí mi opinión personal. Yo creo que
precisamente. I have my personal opinion. I believe that there is no peace in Colombia because we are very close to the U.S. The U.S. has also intensified the Colombian internal conflict. They didn't need to carry out coups or Operation Condor. We have seen the U.S. human rights violations and interventions in almost all Colombian governments. I think that Gustavo Petro's government is an exception in this case. Now the power was divided between liberals and conservatives in Colombia. In the last decade, we also witnessed Uribismo. We should also remember that Juan Manuel Santos, who signed the peace deal, used to be Uribe's defense minister during the Democratic Security government at the height of the war. It is a very complex issue. That's why I'm insisting in a point that the right wing must not come to power so we can guarantee the peace in Colombia. The U.S.'s interventionism must also be stopped. If we can't stop it, we can't reach peace in Colombia.
Debe, como se llama, parar el intervencionismo. Sin embargo, Petro.
I agree with you. Colombia must stop U.S. interventionism. I think that Gustavo Petro has authorized the presence of NATO in some areas in order to protect the environment. This is one of the contradictions. I think that the participation of ex-FARC members in the negotiations can guarantee their lives. This is very complex. We believe in the intelligence and capacity of Colombian people. Mauricio, we are about to finish our program, and I need your opinion about these negotiations between the Colombian government and the National Liberation Army. Can we see such negotiations with other guerrilla groups and bring peace to Colombia? If it doesn't happen, these little organizations will become stronger. The same thing happened when the Colombian government and the FARC signed the peace treaty, and the National Liberation Army emerged on the other side.
I've already mentioned this point. I think that it was a very good step that the Colombian government recognized these groups as political organizations. The National Liberation Army has been recognized as a political and military organization. They aren't known as only a military organization anymore. It is important not to use the word demobilization because they're not going to release troops from active service. They may lay down their weapons. The important point is that they will stay in their places but will leave their weapons. The forms of struggles will be changed. The key point is to recognize them. It has been 70 years that we face the internal conflict in Colombia.
De lucha en Colombia.
60 años. Sí. Y entonces la lucha armada...
70 years of war. The internal armed conflict still exists.
Es que no sé, yo no sé si es un tema, no sé si la lucha armada alguna vez fue una moda. La guerrilla sí.
The internal armed conflict still exists. That's right. It will continue to exist if the Colombian government can't come up with a clear decision to guarantee their lives, because the guerrilla members' families have been assassinated. The Colombian police and military aren't present in these areas. It means that no one guarantees their lives. The Colombian state with parliamentary forces and police are the ones that commit these crimes. Those who have lost their family members will take weapons in their hands and defend themselves.
Y se van a defender.
Así es, Mauricio.
Mauricio, you are right. They had to use their weapons in conflict during all these years. It was the only way for them to be recognized as a political body for their sovereignty, justice, and independence. Thank you very much for accepting our invitation to be on Black and White. I hope to see you next time, because I think that this peace process is in development. Thank you very much.
Está en desarrollo. Muchas gracias.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked among
the holy prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant factor.
Imamat yek asle zinde ast dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu Alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, we're welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Farahzad. Stay tuned. As soon as we are truly regretful about our bad deeds and we confess to our sins, Allah answers our prayer and agony is removed from us. This case is true about all the faithful people. If we want to be forgiven, we must first accept our wrong deeds and ask Allah for forgiveness. Thus, Yunusiyya invocation, which is part of Ayah 87 of Surah Al-Anbiya, can be recited by every faithful person.
Leza Imam Sadiq alayhi salam فرمود تعجب میکنم از کسی که دچار گرفتاری و بنبست و بحران شده.
In a hadith, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam states, I wonder why people who have a problem does not take refuge in the Yunusiyya invocation. In this invocation we read, There is no God except you. You are immaculate. I have indeed been among the wrongdoers. This consideration of ourselves among the wrongdoers and confession to our sins is the first and a major step to find salvation and ask for Allah's forgiveness. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Farhasat. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Hatem Abu Sharia is a Palestinian photographer who was attacked by Zionist regime forces while doing his job. Hatem was also placed in solitary confinement. His conditions were extremely cramped. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, Hatem Abu Sharia is a photographer who was attacked while doing his job. On May 28, 2018, Hatem was covering the Great March of Return, regular protests called to demand respect for basic Palestinian rights. Accompanied by a fellow photographer, he was close to Gaza's boundary with the occupied territories when Zionist regime snipers began firing towards them. Hatem and his colleague managed to find a hiding place where they could avoid the snipers' bullets. While they were spared death, the two men were soon found by the Zionist regime troops. The troops captured both men and took them to the boundary. Hatem said, "They made us take off all our clothes. They kept hitting us until my glasses were broken." Hatem and his colleague were handcuffed and driven to Erez, an Israeli regime military checkpoint. Hatem said, "Even on the road, the Israeli troops kept beating us." That evening, the two men were taken to a prison in Ascalon. When they arrived, the prison's administrators claimed it was too late for them to enter. They had to spend the night outdoors, with the Zionist regime personnel watching over them. Hatem said, "We were handcuffed and we were blindfolded." As it was Ramadan, the two men had been fasting all day. They were not offered anything to eat or drink by their captors that evening. The following morning, the two men were brought into the prison. It was the beginning of a lengthy period during which Hatem was subjected to extreme violence, both overtly physical and psychological. He said, "In almost every interrogation, they beat and tortured me." Hatem was placed in solitary confinement. His conditions were extremely cramped. He said, "Sometimes they put me in a cell that was just 1.5 meters long. I am 1.95 meters tall." Hatem was eventually put on trial in May 2019, a year after his arrest. He was charged with entering the occupied territories unlawfully and photographing military facilities without authorization. He was sentenced to 5 years imprisonment. The sentence included the year he spent in pretrial detention. When he heard of his sentence, he said, "I felt like I wanted to cry. But I didn't want to break down in front of Israeli regime authorities." During the trial, Hatem was kept in Nafha prison. The conditions there were a little better than in Ascalon. He said, "I found people to speak with. I could cut my hair and take a shower after spending 53 days without bathing." Many other prisoners who he met had been handed sentences of 20 or 30 years. Knowing that his own sentence was shorter eased things slightly. Hatem was held in Eshel, a prison in the city of Beersheba, but later transferred to Ketziot, which is located in the Negev region. He was not given any reason for the transfer. He said, "Your name suddenly comes up for transfer. They move you on a whim. You've built up friendships and suddenly you are with new people. They didn't like seeing us happy." Hatem found ways of defying his jailers. Using smuggled mobile phones, he applied to sit the Tawjihi, an exam taken before going to university. The Zionist regime does not allow textbooks into prisons. To challenge that ban, Hatem had the school books smuggled to him. The book's covers and initial 10 pages were altered so that the prison authorities would think that they belong to the categories of permitted reading material. Many other prisoners also sat the exams. As the number of textbooks were available, they developed a system whereby each prisoner would have a book for a week and then hand it over to others. Exam papers are also not allowed, so one prisoner would have to communicate with a particular school, find out the exam questions, and then circulate them among other prisoners. Being able to overcome obstacles created a sense of camaraderie among the prisoners. When Hatem learned he had passed the exam, an impromptu party ensued. Hearing prisoners break into song, the prison authorities demanded to know why so much noise was coming from the cells. Hatem said, "They didn't like seeing us happy." Hatem's mother, Feiga, sought permission via the International Committee of the Red Cross to visit him on numerous occasions. All her requests were turned down. First, the Zionist regime cited security as a pretext. Later, it invoked restrictions introduced amid the COVID-19 pandemic. Following the death of his father in 2015, Hatem's bonds with his mother became increasingly strong. Faiqa said, "Hatem was my right-hand man. When he was imprisoned, I felt like I had lost him." The early stages of Hatem's detention were especially difficult. With almost no information available to her, Faiqa was uncertain that he was alive until he called her one day with a mobile phone smuggled into prison. Eventually, Hatem was released in May this year. Faiqa said, "I shed tears of joy when I could hug him again. The feeling was indescribable." Now aged 28, Hatem is trying to rebuild his life. He has just become engaged. Numerous photographers and reporters were attacked during the Great March of Return by the Zionist regime forces. The Zionist regime killed two photojournalists, Yasser Murtaja and Ahmad Abu Hussein, while they were covering those protests. Nine other media workers were wounded. The Zionist regime's attacks on the press have continued since then. Such attacks caught the attention of the world's media last year when Israeli regime forces killed Shirin Abu Aghile, a journalist with Al Jazeera, in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. While Abu Aghile's killing prompted expressions of concern, so far toothless, from the United States, where she held citizenship, and the European Union, most violence against Palestinian media workers elicits no response from powerful governments. Hatem Abu Sharia is among many whose plight has been ignored.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray five times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, in which we try to ask and answer some of the questions related to the Islamic laws based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, before we embark on our episode, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jad, hosting this program, and shortly with our guest speaker, we are talking about the dress code or some of the Islamic laws related to the dress code based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. My first question, Sheikh Javid, is about buying and selling women's lingerie, especially if men are put to the job. I mean, what's the ruling, what's the jurisprudential law about men buying and selling or trading in women's lingerie?
You're right. Well, according to the answer issued by His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei to a similar question, there is no harm in, you know, in buying or selling women's lingerie.
Mm-hmm.
Per se, it is quite permissible. And he has stated that it is permissible provided that it does not result in any kind of evil or any kind of immorality or indecency or maybe a kind of sin. Because if a woman wears, if a man sells a woman's lingerie and then the woman, because the clients, the men are coming, women are coming in and they buy those things, there is a possibility of the two parties falling into a sin. If there is such a possibility, of course, it's not permissible. If there's no such possibility and one is confident, quite confident, that he will not be led to a sin, to an act, to an immoral act,
mm-hmm.
then there's no problem.
I see. Well, is it permissible, Jeshwabi, to make or buy and sell transparent clothes like stockings?
Well, there is no objection to making and trading in them, provided that they are not intended for women to wear before men, in front of men who are non-mahram to them.
Mm-hmm.
So if that's not the intention, there is no objection to making them, to trading them, selling them, you know, and buying them. It depends on the intention.
Mm-hmm. I see. And is it permissible, Shishovit, for unmarried men, boys actually,
yes,
to work in boutiques selling women's clothes and cosmetics, provided that they abide by religious as well as ethical laws and norms?
Well, the permissibility of legitimate work and earning halal living is not confined to one group of people. It is therefore permissible for anyone to go about their business, provided that they abide by the Islamic norms and ethics and Sharia rules, of course. And, you know, sometimes maybe the authorities require special conditions for trading in certain sectors, which may have been, designed to protect the public interest. And if there is such conditions, then the conditions must be complied with. Because, of course, in an Islamic country, there is an institution, there is an organization that is responsible for setting the dress code or defining the dress code and telling the people who produce such things not to make or produce clothes that are, you know, morally and, you know, offensive. So if there are certain conditions announced by those authorities who are vested with authority, of course, then those conditions must be complied with.
And if they are complied with, those conditions are met.
Yeah, if people violate those conditions, it means that they are acting against Sharia law, because the authorities, they try to implement the Sharia code and tell the tailors or producers or companies or firms to manufacture things which are Sharia compliant.
Mm-hmm.
And if they violate the codes, of course, they are actually going against Islamic Sharia.
Mm-hmm.
So those conditions must be complied with by people who engage in such trade and such in selling women's clothing.
Mm-hmm. But according to the Sharia laws, Sheikh Javid, specifically the fatwa issued by Ayatollah Khamenei, isn't it actually like canonized that, for example, sanctioned by Islamic laws,
yes,
that men, for example, would deal with and trade in men's clothes, for example, and women for women. Like, for example, when you refer to some jewelry shop, you see that there are lots of men involved, but they are selling the gems and
ornaments
or whatever that belongs to the women's department to the women.
Yes.
And apart from the psychological, pressure which is put on the women who are about to buy, for example, those gems or jewelries, what does the Sharia law say in this regard? Like, doesn't it sanction, for example, men trading in men's, for example, stuff and women for women?
Well, you're right to a large extent, but you know, people who run their businesses, like someone who has a jewelry shop, he is running his own business, and the business belongs to the man and not to his wife. Otherwise, I think the wife would sell and sell those things.
But we have business women, as well.
Yeah, it is very much appropriate for ladies to sell ladies' stuff.
Yes.
And for men to wear.
For example, when it comes to underwear,
you're right.
Everybody expects that the women actually sell those stuff to the women, not men.
Yeah, you're right. But even then, His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei says that there's no objection as long as it does not entail any kind of evil.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's take a very late break now. Thank you for actually bearing us up to now. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions. Allah,
guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. We are talking about the Sharia laws, or some of them, about the conspicuous clothes as well as the dress code, whatever, in that department, with Sheikh Javed. Sheikh Javed, what's the jurisprudential law in the matter of men wearing chains? As you can see, in today's world, lots of boys or even men, they are wearing some kind of chains in different metal, of course.
You're right.
You know, they are made of different metals. Some of them are gold, some of them silver, or the other types. So what's the religious law regarding this?
You rightly mentioned the question that you raised was very nice, because in this time around we see men or boys wearing chains, of course. There's no doubt as to the fact that if the chains are made of gold, then it is absolutely forbidden for men to wear any kind of objects that are made of gold, mm-hmm. okay, including a watch made of gold or even a gold-plated watch. Chains made of gold or any kind of bracelets or any items. So because it's explicitly stated in the Sharia sources that men are not allowed to wear gold items. So
does this apply to the false teeth?
Of course, it does. It does.
Like they're not about to wear, men cannot wear, for example, false teeth which are made of gold?
It's not permissible because... especially when it is used as an when it is viewed as an ornament, mm-hmm. because there are substitutes. You can wear, something other than gold, mm-hmm. Which can still have the same function.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So there is also another thing that His Eminence has said that if a chain is for the exclusive use of women,
mm-hmm.
Again, it's not permissible for men to wear them.
I see. Yeah. Okay, thank you very much, Javed, and thank you, my dear listeners, for joining our program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.